Coming up in hour two, the classical music sensation. Over a billion streams of his music, Alexis French. Right, time for news and sport.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News on 5 Live, I'm Alison Hughes. The Lebanese Health Ministry says more than 50 people have died in a day of continued Israeli airstrikes across the country. Israel's military has said it believes 20 senior commanders of the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group died in an attack on Friday. The White House National Security spokesman John Kirby told the US network ABC he expects Iran to respond.
Well, their rhetoric certainly suggests they're going to try to do something. I mean, just coming out of Tehran, but we don't really know. We're watching this very, very closely to see how, if and how, Hezbollah and or Iran may react, as well as the militia groups in Iraq and Syria. We have to be prepared for some sort of response. We have to make sure that we are ready, and we are.
The Israeli military has now expanded its operation against Iranian allies, bombing Houthi targets in Yemen. Israel said the targets, including a seaport, were being used by the Houthis to transfer weapons and oil from Iran. The Foreign Office is advising British people in Lebanon to leave immediately. Ministers say they're working with commercial airlines to make sure more flights are available. Ala Galayini, who's pregnant, is one of those who've managed to get out. She arrived in London this morning.
I was seeing buildings being bombed, huge, huge fires, buildings falling down, collapsing. It wasn't just one bomb, it'll be around 20 after each other and people still stuck under rubble. So you smell it all and it's all over the city, no matter how far you are.
An 8-year-old boy has died after suffering gunshot wounds to the head and face at a farm in Cumbria. A man in his 60s has been arrested on suspicion of assault and gross negligence manslaughter. The former Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has urged his party to stop the squabbling as he addressed the Conservative conference in Birmingham. Mr. Sunak said the conference was a chance to hear from the four Tory leadership contenders, and he urged the party to get behind his successor. This Tory member was among those listening to the speech.
I was actually really surprised about the reaction. It seemed really positive. There was people chanting his name, lots of cheering, which kind of shocked me because, in my opinion, he wasn't a very good leader and we're better off without him. There were people even shouting, like, please stay. I just couldn't quite believe it after delivering such a bad election.
A man in his 20s has been killed and two others are in hospital after being stabbed in South London. Police responded to reports of a large group of people fighting with knives in Lambeth in the early hours of this morning. Projected results in Austria's general election puts the far-right Freedom Party on course to win a narrow victory. There'll have to be coalition talks if the result is confirmed, but some parties have said they wouldn't work with the leader of the Freedom Party. And a former Russian spy and his daughter, who were poisoned by the nerve agent Novichok in Salisbury in 2018, will not have to appear to give evidence to a public inquiry. The judge overseeing the hearings said there was an overwhelming risk of an attack on Sergei and Yulia Skripal. That's the news. John Wilkinson has the sport.
Tottenham made it four wins in a row in all competitions this evening at Old Trafford. 3-0 they beat Manchester United, who were reduced to 10 men when Bruno Fernandes was sent off at 1-0 down. Ipswich made it four draws in a row as they held Aston Villa to 2-2. Rangers beat Hibernian 1-0 in the Scottish Premiership. In rugby union, England women have raced into a 14-0 lead over the USA in their WXV1 opener in Vancouver. And in cricket, England's men have lost the one-day international series to Australia after a rain-affected final match in Bristol.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV licence uni.
Headliners with Nihal Arthanayake.
You're listening to Headliners with Nihal Arthanaika. Coming up between now and 10 p.m, my conversation with Alexis French.
You're about to hear a conversation with a genius. And the reason that I say this will become self-evident when I tell you that my next guest was writing pieces of music for string quartets when he was 5 years old. By the age of 10 or 11, he was at the Royal Academy. He is, without question, one of the most talented classical composers and also a really nice dude. His name is Alexis French.
The biggest names. Headliners with Nihal Arthanaika.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
I wish when you'd seen me at a party, we'd chatted then.
Do you know what it was? I was with my son and my daughter. I had to persuade them to go to the after party of the Brits at the Shard. And I remember we were walking in, my son and I don't know where my daughter was at the time, Little Mix just kind of floated by. And then in you came, Nihal. And at that time, I don't know, I was listening to so many hours of Nihal a day, and you were my favourite broadcaster. And I toyed with the idea of walking up and presenting myself, but I think my son had other plans for where
I would
he wanted
have been
to
humbled.
Go.
If you had done that, Alexis, that would have been incredible. Who's genuinely famous have you again decided not to go up and see when they're in the same room?
Well, the last one I think is when we were in Greece. I heard this voice holidaying with the family. Heard this voice, really sonorous, kind of mellifluous tone. It was beautiful. This voice, I thought I recognised that. So I couldn't see the chap, I could just hear the voice. And I thought, I think I used to teach that voice back when I was a teacher. And sure enough, I called out Charlie, thinking it was Charlie from Busted. And I turned the corner, and it was Charlie, my ex-student, who I used to teach when he was 13 years old, and encouraged him at the time when I taught at Uppingham School to leave school and audition for this band called Busted. And he then left school and I got in loads of trouble. So anyway, that was the voice. But this is going somewhere, I promise you. But then, just after that, we went to a cafe. Just after I met Charlie, this tall sort of figure came past.
Well, Charlie's pretty tall, isn't he?
Yeah, but even taller. And it was the Greek tennis player.
And it was Tsitsipas.
That's it, Tsitsipas. And he had his sort of groupies around. It was surrounded. I toyed with the idea of saying hello, but I didn't at the time. And I don't regret that, to be honest with you. Great tennis player, but no. Do you know, it's only a few people I'd actually run up to and say, look, I don't know. I don't know what it would take. Yeah.
As a man of Jamaican stock, what about Usain Bolt?
Yes. It's just a yes.
I just would.
You would?
Yeah. And he is incredible. Like, years ago, I was coming back from, I can't remember which Olympics it was, and he was on the same plane. I think it was Rio.
Right. Yeah.
He was on the same plane as us. The pilot came over the tunnel and just said, look, we're going to be delayed a while because there's a backlog of planes trying to land at Heathrow.
Yeah.
And then about 2 minutes later, he went, oh, because of a certain VIP we have on board, we've just been cleared to land.
No.
Like, that is the power of Usain Bolt.
No.
He can make a runway free.
Ooh.
And then we got off.
Yeah.
He's standing there.
Yeah.
And he is posing for photos with everyone. He gives every single person who's waiting there to collect their luggage his time.
Aww.
It was the most incredible. It was like, you are such a student.
Such a gift. And did you?
I didn't. And I'll tell you why I didn't.
Okay.
Because I work in this game,
and
because there is a likelihood at one point I thought I might meet him, I might interview him, it's not my place to take up that 30 seconds that could be for someone.
Okay.
That I'll just...
Does that go for everybody, or is there one person for whom, actually, do you know what, I might break that room.
It's okay, so I interviewed Jeff Goldblum.
Yes,
right?
Cool cat.
Very cool guy.
Mm.
Then on... And the train on the way back to Manchester that night.
Yeah.
I'm walking through first class.
Yeah.
I'm not sitting in first class, but I need to find a toilet that's free.
Yeah.
So I walk past first class. He's there.
Yeah.
and he's asleep. And I think it's a good idea, and I don't know why I did this to this day, to try and wake him to tell him, oh, Jeff, I met you today. But when I went to reach him just to kind of tap him, I felt this vice-like grip as if my arm was going to be broken off by his security guy who was sitting in front of him on the train.
My goodness me.
At which point, luckily, he recognised me and went, oh, OK, yeah, no, he was on the radio with him. And then Jeff Goldblum kind of woke up, looked at me. I went, hi, Jeff. I did the interview. And he just went, oh, OK, thanks. Like in this half awake stupor. It was terrible.
My gosh, that sounds horrific.
It was a rubbish thing to do. Like, why would I do that?
I don't know. Why would you do that and not to Usain Bolt? Like, when he was just... when he was just there, like, waiting for it.
All right, OK. So who, as an incredible composer and pianist as you are, who have you been most freaked out by discovering that they are a fan of you?
OK, this is going to sound a little bit bougie, for which many, many apologies. I am not this guy. But on this occasion, I was in the Royal Box at Wimbledon and with my wife. And for us...
What?
No, but for us, it was a big deal, okay? It's not like...
What do you mean for us? For anyone? For Tom Cruise, that's a big deal.
It was a big deal. I was sitting next to Lin-Manuel and the other side of me was the Spider-Man dude and it just went on and on and on. By the way, you know when you go to those things, there are biographies in a programme. And so everybody has their biography. I didn't know this, by the way. Anyway, and it was became clear very, very quickly as hushed kind of just came over the entire room that the Princess of Wales was walking up the stairs and was going to enter the room imminently. And the person she came up to and presented was me. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness me. And then after about 10 minutes or so of me talking to this amazing being, my
she
goodness me.
She spent about 10 minutes with you?
Well, 10 minutes until I kind of calmed myself down. Everyone else sort of disappeared into lunch, and I was just there talking to her, and she was just the most gracious, warm, generous person. And I was utterly freaked out, I've got to say. But we had a really good conversation.
It purely about music?
It was about music and I suppose, you know,
the gift of music.
Yeah, and she knew who I was and I'm kind of, I'm always amazed when anyone knows who I am. I just am, Nihal. I remember the first time it was one of my albums, Evolution, came out and I was talking to Simon Mayo and it had done really, really well. And he said, are you pleased with the reception? And I just said, look, I'm just pleased it's been received at all. It's just, you know, when you write a book or you create something new and you put it out into the world and you kind of sharp intake of breath. And I'm like that every day because it's such a, I just feel this immense sense of gratitude at being able to do the stuff I do and for people to derive any sense of comfort from it and let alone take the time to walk up and chat. So yeah, that was a beautiful moment.
I want you to tell me immediately your memories and your emotions when I say saltfish fritters.
Oh, wow. So immediately, saltfish fritters, home, my mother, midnight mass, comfort, and family. That's what I think of.
I'm going to ask you a question. I don't want this to sound weird. It's off the back of a book I read and a chap I interviewed called Lord Sewell, who wrote a book called Black Success, right? And in it, he talked about how African families... West African families that do very, very well, kids do very well, etc. But when you get over to the Caribbean and Jamaica specifically, there are a lot of single parent families involved. Quite a high percentage, in fact. I think he said something like 60% in the UK. That wasn't your experience.
No, it wasn't. And also, it's interesting you bring that up because actually I was looking at these figures recently because I always remember going back years and years and years when I was teaching. And there was a colleague of mine who came up to me, I think he was a history teacher, and he sort of entered into this conversation. It was just out of the blue. I just looked at him sort of slightly quizzically and this is the thing that you want to talk to me about. And I just said, look, it's not hereditary, you know, it's not but in recent times, I remember looking at it again and looking at the figures. My experience was of a very loving, family, my father and my mother. It was a very religious family. It was one that I would characterise as being very loving and
very hardworking, as
very
well.
Disciplined. Yeah. And there was a sort of everydayness culture about it, about everything, about the reading, the going to church, the practicing, the maths, lots and lots of maths for some reason. And that was all I knew. But that's not untypical for West Indian families, that idea of discipline. And, you know, people have this idea of you know, when people talk about Jamaica, they often think of sunshine, beaches, you know, this idea of laid-back culture. And you often read it in, you know, poor attitude in the workplace and all this stuff. And these words, people think of West Indian culture as thinking somehow less than discipline, less than, yes. You know, not on time and all this stuff. Far from my experience.
It's a question that I was interested in because I remember having a conversation with John Barnes.
Mm-hmm.
And John Barnes talked of black success in a way that said that you elevate yourself out of blackness. And he said that about Stormzy, that Stormzy had elevated himself out of blackness because of success. And I found that profoundly depressing because it said to me that you couldn't be black and successful, that for him, black meant that you were living in a certain environment, in a certain family environment, and that by your success and by the wealth that you accrue from that success, then you're suddenly no longer connected to your community because of that.
Mm. It's an interesting notion, isn't it? I have considered this in the past. I remember when I was giving a talk at a college that was headed by my good friend, Lord Simon Woolley, and it was about the liberation of intellectual wealth, black intellectual wealth. And when I was introduced at the time, the famous black, and this is the prefix that they used. And I found that rather curious. And that, although I wasn't going to do so, that became the start of my talk. This idea of homogenization. We can use this term black and it describes, I find it very reductive actually. As a term, unless the art that you're putting out into the world is somehow representative of that ethnicity. So, you know, if you're a Native American artist, for instance, is the art Native American? Well, yes, it is. Well, in that case, it's entirely relevant. What I do is universal. And when I was growing up, I didn't actually subscribe to these false binaries that seem to pervade everything that we do today. The world today is about the black and white, the nothing in between, the lack of nuance, and it's partly what's going on in politics at the moment, and precisely why we have so much divisive rhetoric. My world was just, it was limitless in terms of possibility, and I was able to draw from this sort of patchwork of influences, figures, and I didn't look at the black or the whiteness of it all. And I find it quite depressing that these are the times that we live in, because that's not the art that I make. I am a black man, and I'm profoundly proud of that. I'm profoundly proud of my heritage and the sacrifices that my parents made. But it doesn't define who I am or the art that I make. And I think that we're sort of grown up and adult enough to appreciate the nuances within that. So I don't subscribe to the notion that when one becomes, you know, achieves a certain level of success, that somehow you grow out of your ethnicity. I don't believe in that at all.
How would you respond to someone trying to use you as an example against diversity and inclusion initiatives, against quotas, against affirmative action, saying, look, it's hard work. It's hard work and discipline. It's nothing to do with racism or structural racism. It's about the fact, look at Alexis French, composer, pianist. His family believed in hard work, discipline, focus. They were together. There was faith. That's what you need. It's not to do with colour.
It's not only hard work, it's also circumstance and it's also opportunity. And I've worked enough with communities, organisations to know that the kind of opportunities that are afforded to me are not necessarily afforded to everybody. And not everybody is fortunate enough to grow up in a loving home, for instance, or attend the schools that they deserve. And so it's not only about hard work. I'm certainly not saying that at all. I remember working with the Prince's Trust years and years ago, and it was a week I spent with these young people. I think it was about aged 18 to 35. And we started off at Royal Albert Hall. And I just remember being really petrified about going into this experience. It was basically with me, Sony Music's Social Justice Fund, and then Prince's Trust. And so I went into this and with a fair degree of trepidation. And the people I met, changed me forever during that week. I remember we started off the week by writing letters to each other by way of contextualizing who we are and where we'd come from. And I remember this one chap who wrote this letter, this incredibly gifted young man who was on day release. And I just read this and tears started to come down my eyes because I realized, oh my goodness me, the challenges, the level of challenge that this guy, and he's coming in, he's full of smiles, he's open, he's got this talent, like incredible talent. He was a rapper. And the challenges that he faced just with his mother were just incredible, things that I could have never have coped with. So I would most certainly, if somebody were to say to me, I'm example, if I can do it, anyone can do it. That is not the case. You know, people do need a hand. And this is a tough environment. This is a sort of a multi-tiered landscape, I would say, in this country. There's loads of talent out there as unfulfilled because they've not yet had the opportunity.
But Alexis, you're a prodigy. You know, this isn't, you know, you, there are people that can drive an F1 car and then there's Lewis Hamilton, right? There's people that can run 100 metres and they're Usain. But I mean, you have a gift.
But you don't come into that. I remember doing stuff when I was very young, and it's precisely that you do stuff, right? And I remember writing string quartets when I was about 4, 5, 6, a church organist when I was 7. And it's only really when you get in amongst it, like I went to the Royal Academy and I was in classes with 18-year-olds and I was 11 because, you know, these kind of, because I have perfect pitch and they had to say, well, we're going to write down these things. And I remember looking around and people were toiling. And I just, you know. And
you hadn't seen that before, had you?
People were struggling. And it was only when I realised that actually, this is like, so it's not like you go around, you know, you just do what you do and you work hard. But before the talent, you put the work. It's the work before the talent. Because without that, there's nothing. And so every day I dedicated myself to being better than I was the day before.
That came from your dad, right?
Most definitely. Right. And it also was this notion of, well, Alexis, you know, we are guests in this country. You'll need to work twice or three times as hard as your white counterparts. That is not unusual.
No, it's not. I heard exactly the same thing. Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you still feel like a guest?
No, I don't feel like a guest.
Did the riots in the summer make you question that?
I was away during the riots.
So was I, yeah.
Yeah, I was in Italy. And I remember talking to because my children were with me on holiday. They're adults, 21, 23, respectively. And my wife in this beautiful villa in the middle of nowhere. I remember talking to my son, Joe, and saying, we've seen this. And we're having these little chats. And the more we were talking about it, and my wife is going to kill me now, the more my wife was getting annoyed, actually, to the fact we were actually paying attention to this thing when we were on holiday. But for us, it was real. I was concerned. And I didn't know what I was going to be coming back to.
I mean, that Wednesday when everyone came out to go, we're not having this anymore.
Yeah.
I remember it was a Wednesday night. And thankfully, the people of Britain came out and represented.
They
and
did.
Said, no, this is not us. These people are not us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's how I like to think that Britain is, actually. People talk about institutional racism and you know, of all the countries, I mean, I think this is a wonderful, wonderful country, right?
Best, actually.
The best.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to be an American.
No. absolutely. Of course, there are idiots around. And, you know, it's interesting that term of I remember when I first encountered barefaced racism. There was two experiences actually when I was very young. One was when I just got into the Royal Academy of Music when I was 11 years old, and my teacher presented the class. I don't want to go down this road, but since we're in this...
Yeah, we're in this space now.
And my teacher gave these lyrics to the class to sing. And the refrain of this song was, "And I jumped on an N because I thought he was a horse." And everybody now. And I jumped now. And this is true. And the class was singing.
This is in the 1980s, right?
Yeah, and this is the song after the... Because I remember just before the class, the teacher said to me, "And did you pass your audition to this place?" I said, "Yes." And during the class that followed, he gave these lyrics I think it was the music teacher.
And were you the only black
child? Yes, I was, yeah.
In the class?
And then you grow up really fast when you hear that kind of stuff. And you come to realise, okay, that's what that looks like.
Can I just, at the risk of kind of, I'm definitely not trying to give this teacher a get out jail card. Was this teacher of a generation that probably didn't realise?
No, he was a young man.
He knew the power of this word, negativity around this word.
Yeah, he was a young man. And I remember.
Did he relish it? I mean, you can't see into his mind, but.
He loved it. He absolutely loved it. I remember telling my parents afterwards. My parents, you know, they were of a generation, and also they were the Jamaican, come over to this country, and there was a certain deference towards authority and education. I remember they didn't challenge, I don't think they challenged it. So it happened, and there was another instance, not with a teacher, but with a boy. And those are the only two experiences in my life that I can remember thinking, okay, that's what that looks like. The guy was an idiot. And that's how I look at it, and I move on. He's an idiot, and there's a darkness inside of him, and I move on. One remembers, but it doesn't leave a sort of indelible sort of mark on me, and I move on. There are those people in the world. We just have to accept that, and we move on.
Give me a sense of the type of conversation you had with your kids after the murder of George Floyd.
I didn't talk to them about that. Because they weren't with me at the time. So again, I've got grown up kids. And also I had to process that myself. So I do remember that day. And I remember that moment. It's not necessarily something I want to really, but it was a very raw thing. I remember I went down to the piano and improvised an opera that I had to record, had to work through everything, and it was like this 30-40 minute thing, and that was my way of dealing with it. It's just so utterly, you know, just horrifying. But it's not a conversation, it's not a sort of family dinner experience that we would sit around and talk about that. I think everyone has to process that in their own way, in their own time.
How did it connect you to community, seeing how the world reacted to it, whether it be footballers taking a knee or whether it be the protests that happened or, you know, the making of the video for Walk With Us, the track that you wrote around
that? Yeah, it certainly prompted action within me. I felt that after a period of reflection, and I felt that I needed to do more. I do remember literally looking in the mirror and examining my sort of motivations, who I was, and my interactions with the wider world, and what I could do more within the community to affect positive change. And so it was after that, I remember during that phase of all the marches and that sort of stuff, I remember improvising when people were singing, just basically forming the accompaniment on the piano and then posting it onto the internet. You know, people marching, singing a song. Okay, here's the harmonic progression to underpin what you're singing there, just to elevate it. Not moving the dial, I'm sure, at all, but I just felt that I was with them and interacting in some way. But then more, I suppose, more sort of demonstrable sort of activities, getting involved with the Sony Music Social Justice Fund, launching scholarships over here with the Royal Academy of Music, also the Walk With Us that you've already mentioned, which is a piece of music. And it's interesting the way that, you know, people talk about or frame those conversations or particularly where it pertains to Black Lives Matter. And in some circles, it's become sort of almost like a dirty word. And I find that extraordinary, actually, because we're talking about human lives. We're talking about decency, and it's not political. We're talking about humanity here. So I find that you know, just the fact that it's been corrupted or hijacked in that way, really deplorable.
I mean, the phony culture war has managed to make even avocados political. So, I mean, and tofu.
Oh, yeah.
So the culture war is this. Listen, we've got so much to talk about. I definitely want to talk about Stevie Wonder and Sam Cooke and Etta James
and all of the music
that you grew up listening to. And I definitely want to talk about Classical Soul Volume 1. And we shall do that after the news and sport.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News on 5 Live, I'm Alison Hughes. The Lebanese Health Ministry says more than 50 people have died in a day of continued Israeli airstrikes across the country. Israel's military has said it believes 20 senior commanders of the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group died in an attack on Friday, which killed its leader, Hassan Nasrallah. Israel has also carried out airstrikes on a Red Sea port in Yemen, which it claims Houthis used to transfer weapons and oil. This evening, President Biden said an all-out war in the Middle East must be avoided. An 8-year-old boy has died after being shot in the head at a farm in Cumbria yesterday. A man in his 60s is being questioned by police on suspicion of gross negligence manslaughter. And projected results in Austria's general election put the far-right Freedom Party on course to win a narrow victory. There'll have to be coalition talks if the result is confirmed. That's the news. John Wilkinson has the sport.
Thank you. The Tottenham boss, Ange Postecoglou, says we're a strong outfit and today confirms that. It's after a 3-0 win at 10-man Manchester United in the Premier League. Dominic Solanke and Brennan Johnson extended their scoring runs, but as for United, they're 12th in the table. Erik ten Hag says they have to move forward in the right way.
We have to deal with this. We have to show resilience because this is not good enough. We have to accept this, and from that point on, we have to do things better. For the next game, focus on this and do things better.
Ipswich remain without a win in the top flight, but it's 4 draws in a row for the newly promoted side now. They held Aston Villa to 2-2, and boss Kieran McKenna is satisfied enough with that.
It's such a tough division, it's really hard to pick up points, it's even harder to win games, and that's going to be a big fight for us all season, but I think we're doing a lot of the right things, and I think we're learning from, you know, the things we need to improve on.
Rangers won in the Scottish Premiership, beating Hibernian 1-0, whilst in the Women's Super League there were wins for Manchester City, Manchester United and Arsenal, whilst Chelsea against Manchester United next weekend has been postponed. It's because of a conflict with the Blues' European schedule. To rugby union, and England women have started the defence of their WXV1 title in Vancouver. They're playing and currently beating the USA, Sarah Orchard.
Yeah, USA are trailing at the moment. Only 7 points that they have on the board compared to England's 28. Second half just underway, and England have scored those 4 tries, including a 20th international score for captain Alex Matthews. The other efforts came through Lark Atkin-Davis, Ellie Kildan and Georgia Brock. But you have to say, fly half Zoe Harrison, she's the one catching the eye 100% with the boot and taking her opportunity in the starting 10 shirt. It's USA 7, England 28.
And you can watch on the BBC Sport website, the iPlayer and the Red Button. Also in rugby, Bath beat Leicester by 20 points to 15 in the Premiership earlier. England's men have lost their one-day international series against Australia. The deciding match in Bristol ended in a 49-run defeat under DLS because of the rainy conditions. Stephen Finn on the TMS podcast saw positives during the 5 matches, though.
9 of the guys that have played in this series for Australia played in that World Cup final, I think. So there is a gulf in experience there, and I think that showed today when England were 202-2. So England clearly on a learning curve. I think Ben Duckett at the top of the order has been a really positive thing. I really like the look of Jacob Bethel, but you can just tell when he gets bogged down, he doesn't have that experience. And he's someone that I like the look of, but he's going to have to play a lot more.
And the United States are closing in on victory over the international team at golf's President's Cup in Montreal.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Checkered Flag Podcast. Keeping you up to date with everything Formula One.
It has been utter dominance for Lando Norris, who wins the Singapore Grand Prix.
It was an amazing race.
guys. A few too many close calls. I'm a bit out of breath, but very fun one.
Next up, Austin, Texas, and an intense six-race sprint to the end of the year.
The Checkered Flag Podcast. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Headliners. With Nihal Arthanayake.
Welcome back to Headliners with me, Nihal Arthanayake, and most importantly, far more important than my name,
please.
Alexis French is here, the
great
composer,
to be with you,
pianist, and incredibly successful, of course, number one classical albums, and it was half a billion streams. Is that what I saw? Half a billion?
I think it's a billion now, Nihal.
It's a billion.
Just to update you, like double
what I thought it was. Jeez.
Gosh.
A billion streams.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Do those numbers mean anything to you? Or there comes a point where it's just like, I'll let others worry about that stuff? Or are you so super competitive that you will... Look, I mean, Elton John is across the numbers. He's across, you know, sales, also other people's sales, et cetera, et cetera. Are you that guy?
So there's a lot of answers to that question. I'll give you just a few of them. So when I started putting stuff into stream platforms, DSPs, I was not with a label. I wasn't even thinking about labels, but I was putting out my own music through my own record label. And it was only when I met a certain gentleman who's with me today, I won't say him because he likes to remain in the... he says to me, Alexis, are you aware how that you've got this number of streams? And of course I wasn't, because I wasn't interested in the numbers. I was disinterested in the music.
Right.
Now, the numbers enable me to keep on making music.
Yes.
And if those numbers were faltering, that wouldn't be possible for me. People wouldn't be interested in being in business with me. So for that reason, it is important, but it's not what motivates me.
Let's talk Stevie.
Okay.
Let's talk about Stevie. Your dad playing the music of Stevie, of
yeah.
Etta James, of Sam Cooke. This
yeah.
is pivotal for you, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it was a real sort of education. I talked about the everyday culture of my house, and the music that I heard downstairs, I was able to absorb it, appreciate it, of course, but also dissect it in a sort of analytical way, sonically, musically, harmonically. And it was in the music of Stevie Wonder that I found unrestrained delight because of the harmonic complexity. And so tapping away as I did on the kitchen table age 4, playing...
Before you had a piano.
Before I had a piano.
Yeah, you were imagining that it was a piano in front of you.
It kind of, for me, it was a piano. Because, and so I mapped it out geographically, not physically. There weren't any writings on it. It was a wooden table. But I used to practice the table with Stevie Wonder for hours at a time, just tapping away. Because of what was coming across to me from the record was just so articulate. The music was just so articulately presented. I was able to learn the piano from the kitchen table. So by the time we got a piano when I was like 4 and a half, I was able to play chords from the kitchen table. I'd sort of graduated from wooden table to piano by virtue of my exposure to Stevie Wonder's music. The interesting thing is, if you listen to that music, and this is part of the breaking down the hierarchy of music today, or even classical music, you know, classical music seen through this kind of Schenkerian prism, the start of all music, or Bach, this is where music, but actually if you consider the music of that, of those soul greats, particularly Stevie Wonder and others, of course, Marvin Gaye, what is going on in terms of musical complexity here? We don't often do that, actually, you know, in schools, in colleges. Let's consider it for music's sake, not only the icons, but actually let's consider the music and the scholarly musicology of what's happening. And that's what I was doing when I was that age.
The author, best-selling author Harlan Coben once said, a novel is a little bit like a sausage, right?
Mm.
You eat a sausage,
mm.
but you don't want to know how it's made,
mm.
right? You don't necessarily need to know how it's made,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But what you've just said is kind of the opposite of that, actually, is that you do want to know how it's made. You do want to understand what goes into making a song.
It's received. So it's not like a process of sitting down and getting out a pen and paper that music is received. So at the time I hear music, I see the score. So I can see, it's the same with a symphony, I see every note that everyone's playing. The double bassist, and it's not. So with Stevie Wonder, I was listening to music and then it's kind of imbibing this music and then you examine it in your head. But it's always in silence. And that's why today, to this day, I practice in silence, because I found that that's the most sort of profound musical experience that I personally have, is just hearing the music there, but not externally.
Okay, so that's a very intimate
experience
of music.
It's a very powerful musical experience, but it goes back to that, you know, the first days, the arc of how I first learnt how to play the piano. I don't know if it's exclusive to Stevie Wonder. I mean, I often hear Marvin Gaye also moves me in that way, listening back to Marvin Gaye's tracks. And Sam Cooke, there's something about the music, particularly of that time, the earnestness and the soulfulness and the authenticity. And I think also the production methods as well. You could hear the layers and the textures in a way which was just really clear and pure.
Well, listening to Classical Soul Volume 1, this question came up in my mind because it's so beautiful and I connect with it so emotionally. But I know, obviously, how good you are at what you do. So I wondered about the process whereby, as a composer, you realise that your technical proficiency
yes.
and showing the world your technical proficiency isn't as important as forming an emotional connection with a listener.
That's a great question. I mean, for me, that's the only thing that's important. And in my training, throughout my training, there are so many things, so many hurdles, so many hoops we're jumping through, master certain techniques pianistically or compositionally. But it's only really when I learned how to be an effective excavator and slowly peeling away at those layers, subtracting all of the time, distilling even, until you get down to the truth of what really matters. And that's a question that I often ask. In fact, on my Apple Music show, I said to my producer, I really want to speak to young composers and ask them a question: what matters most to you? Because I think this is a really, really key question. And I came to that question really quite late. And even later to the question, post-pandemic, of asking the question to listeners, what do you need from me right now? So all that other stuff, all of the apparatus, the complexity, and these kind of the artificial constructs that we build around this thing that we call classical, for me, that's all superfluous. The only thing that really matters are matters of the heart. And I think any good or great composer worth their salt will be able to speak to that emotion. And that's the thing that we should be teaching, I believe.
How comfortable are you with searching deep within yourself emotionally to find that which will connect with others?
I'm comfortable to the extent that there's capacity, and there's sort of ever changing capacity, I think. So then there needs to be the right conditions in order to really reflect deeply. I like to take myself away from sort of normal situations, whether that be, you know, moving to a different location. They don't have to be exotic locations, you know, but I like to take myself away from the norm, from the usual buildings or the usual people or the usual conversations, because I like to, and this might sound a little strange, to travel as far as I can away from myself to give myself a different perspective. And that's, I'm conscious that that's what I need in order to thrive. So when I'm looking to sort of accelerate that period of reflection or introspection, that's often what I try to do, is to take myself away.
You would have used music many times throughout your life, Alexis, to process things that are happening around you.
Mm-hmm.
How useful or not was music after your father passed?
Well, I think, you know, it's tough. There isn't a week that goes by that I don't speak to a person about my dad passing. I recently lost my mother too, and it's, you know, blokes and their dads, it's a powerful thing. I'm fortunate because I got to tell my dad that I loved him the day before he died. I remember when I was about 4 or 5, he said, "Alexis, we don't kiss anymore. This is what we do." And he put out his strong hand and shook my hand. There was no "I love yous." It wasn't that lovey-dovey kind of... It didn't mean he didn't. It just meant that's so, just not how he expressed himself, and that's fine. He was,
like our parents were, their show, not tell, right?
Yeah.
Right? "I'll show you I love you."
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
"By my deeds."
"By my deeds." And my dad was tough, you know. I mean, he used to get me up at 5 o'clock in the morning, even in school holidays when he was leaving for his Air Force, because in his words, not my words, only unemployed people lie in. This is what I had. This is my... "You get up, and you get up now, and you go to work." I remember being so tired and just wanting to go to bed, and he said, "No, you're going to read that book before you go to bed." And I just remember wanting to escape and just be anywhere else, because the house was just... it was work. It was 3 hours of this work. I mean, unbelievable. And I remember resenting it hugely. And I remember also, you know, winning stuff when I was a little boy, like music competitions. And I remember coming home to my dad and saying, "Dad, I just won that. Aren't you going to say anything?" And he said, "No, you're an investment." And I remember that comment going from me and thinking, "Dude, that's the harsh you are." And there's harsh and there's harsh. But that it didn't mean he didn't love me. And I know he did. But it was only when he died and I was sort of looking through his effects, just tidying his spaces, and I found that he'd kept details of every single concert, every single album, trying to... He said to me, I've written this will, and every single password was set up in my name. I think I was like, it was just so powerful, and just, oh, my goodness me. But if I could have my time again, I'd go back and I'd say those words to him, and I'd just say, "Dad, come on, you gotta. So, you know, so I tell my kids I love them, and they need to know that. I tell them every day. It's important stuff.
When my dad died, which was 24 years ago, of a heart attack, I remember at the time I was working in PR, and one of my clients was Mos Def, the rapper, who's now called Yasin Bey. And his father said to me, "Your dad has stepped aside to allow you to become a man." Which resonated a lot with me, because I felt like as long as he was alive, I was still a child in many ways.
Yes, understood.
Like, he'd raise his voice and I was 10 again, right? Yeah, like, even though I was in my 30s, like, I was like, oh my God, I'm a child again.
Understood, yeah.
But I still have my mum with me. She's in her 80s now. And you, as you pointed out, sadly, very sadly lost yours. So what happens when you lose your mother?
It's more difficult for a number of different reasons. So my mother was very poorly for a long period of time, and in her bedroom for a great many years.
So in many ways you lost her gradually over a period of time.
In terms of her spirit.
Right.
And she didn't want to leave that room as well. And
that was the same as my grandmother, yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
And I fought for a long time to... I managed to get her out for a week. And it was when my father died. I have two sisters as well. And we were not on the same page. Because I know how much life my mum still had in her, even though her body was not willing. And I know how much there was still much to live for. And anyway, it's a long story, but... just a contradiction of emotions, actually, and just so many things that I feel and think. But I'm grateful now that she's without pain, and she's in a better place. And, you know, I think I dreamt about them just a week ago, my dad and my mum together. And I always tell my wife when these things happen, and I said, and they came, my mum was standing... haven't seen my mum standing for, you know, and she was well and she was in a lovely suit. And I just turned to them and I said, "Why are you so smart?" And I know this is going to make me sound crazy. And they said, "Oh, because," but it was just so real. And I kind of believe in that stuff, you know.
Yes.
And, but anyway.
Yes, that's incredible. That's incredible. And again, I guess it's the same question in many ways about how then you go and sit at a piano. Or do you... I mean, it's interesting. I was speaking to an author, I think it was Marianne Keyes, and she had quite serious problems with alcohol.
Uh-huh.
And people would always ask her, is the writing the therapy? And she would say, and I thought this was quite an interesting answer, she would say, no, writing is not the therapy. I have to have therapy in order to be able to do the writing. I can't use that as therapy.
The interesting thing about writing, so there's the writing for me and there's the playing, and, and I guess, you know, in the common vernacular, the production, as it were, whatever that thing is.
Yeah, and the recording.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. But for me, there's this kind of a level of intersectionality within all of those things. And I felt this from ever since I was tapping along to Stevie Wonder. As I mentioned, the sonics of the record, the playing, the acknowledgement of the arrangement and what's going on, the orchestration. So I never take myself away sometimes to consider what I want to do in terms of composition. It's not a process because I'm always composing. So I'm always, it's just something that's always there.
Like an author that has to sit down and compose a book 5 hours a day. You can't wait for the muse to strike. You have to sit there and you have to discipline yourself to create the muse.
Yeah. I if there's something like I need to do, like this is an album and I need to orchestrate this thing, there is clearly a process because it needs to live in dots in order to communicate with other musicians for them to play. But essentially the music, if you said to me, well, look, I need you to go create this symphony, whatever, I could go next door and do it now and it'd be there in real time because it's always there. It's a case of excavating and pulling it away. There wouldn't need to be necessarily a 5 hours a day thing. What I spend my time doing in terms of the day-to-day, apart from the business side and talking to partners and liaising with different companies, is I spend my time practicing in silence. So if I'm going to sit down somewhere, I'll spend my time practicing in silence. It will be Bach, it will be Beethoven, it will be Szymanowski, it will be... because I need to be connected to that core. You know, you mentioned Schoenberg, although he wouldn't necessarily be part of my musical diet. You know, people in that oeuvre and of that classical canon, because it's very important to me, even though I'm not putting that stuff on record now, that it's still part of my daily practice.
Recording this album at Brad Pitt's studio in France.
Yes.
Mirabel, I mean, let's just talk about what that studio is like.
Oh, man. You would love it. I think you would love this studio. I went there not as some kind of vanity project. I will say I went there because a very good friend of mine, Stefan Mocchio, who writes for The Weeknd and other people, told me about this place. And Stefan is a pianist now, so that's what he does. He's always been a pianist, but that's what he does front and center on record now, as opposed to writing, producing. And so I was, you know, just DMing him back and forth. And he said, yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. So I thought, you know what? Let's commit to this place. We were looking at a number of places, but spiritually it felt most aligned to what I wanted to do. So, we got it. My amazing manager got it all arranged for me. My wife, Leslie came along and, she travels with me a lot these days. Cause I think that's one of the beauties of doing what I do is she gets to experience these things. So on this estate, hundreds and hundreds of miles on this estate, surrounded by all these security posts, as you imagine, driving through these lanes, vineyard after vineyard, snaking through this beautiful scenery, and then past us on this incredible villa on the right. It seemed like a castle. It was just incredible. Past the petting zoo. There's petting zoos on the left. Past the champagne pools. There's a champagne pool, perfect depth, so you could just have a nice little dip, but also hold a glass of champagne. And then we pull up, and this incredible guy, Damien Quintard, who teamed up with Brad to create this facility, was waiting for us. One of the most incredible guys you've ever just so creative, classical producer, created this facility, took us to our quarters, this tower, this turret. And then you basically have Brad staff for the week. So every morning you come down, you have three chefs saying, I mean, it's almost embarrassing. It's almost embarrassing.
Especially when the bill comes
in. It is. Yeah. And then every day I get to spend at the piano and this beautiful, beautiful instrument. We had a choice of like seven Steinway grand pianos.
Seven Steinways?
Yeah, so we chose this one. I got them, you know, picked the sound specifically. It was just such a treat. And I spent my day there. My wife was in the champagne pool, I hasten to add, or the gym, Brad's gym there, with all his written sort of exercise plans on there as well. And it was just an incredible place. It was like no other. So I thought it's difficult. It'd be difficult to go to another studio to record piano after. I mean, where do you go, you know, after Miraval? But
Why did he do it? Why did Brad Pitt want to have one of the world's best recording studios?
You know, I've never had the opportunity to ask Brad, but I think from what I can understand, he's a music lover, yeah. As you would expect. And he's also a creator, and he very much appreciates the act of creation and wants to support that in the best way possible. And so he teamed up with one of the best brains in the business, Damien Quintard, to deliver that. So, it's not just classical artists who go there. No, you have Travis Scott, and you have some of the best artists in the world, the hip hop and all those cats. And the place is pristine. You know, it's like the spaceship, like a white spaceship. And then beyond that, of course, you have the recording space. And I remember day two, I thought, you know what? I was just feeling really relaxed and vibey. I thought, I'll take a drink in there. And I just tripped up. And this coffee, right, it just... I mean, we're not just talking a spill here. All over the walls, it was like this projectile nightmare. And so I just popped into the control room and said, look, guys, I'm so sorry. I mean, it wasn't a control room. Thank goodness it wasn't a control room. But it's all over the floors. And, of course, me, I just wanted to be a good boy. I just went to get the nearest kind of mop or thingamajig and just started writing down. And Damien came through, I can't remember who it was. He said, look, don't relax, smile on their face. And then this army of cleaners came in. It was just like, it's like choreographed and just cleaned it all up. And it was like, my goodness me. I mean, I did it. I should be the one who cleans this all up. But they just said, no, leave it alone. But that was probably the lowest moment of the entire experience. But other than that, it was just incredible.
With every headline, the crowd bays for an encore.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
And the encore selection are these quick fire questions that I'm going to give you.
Okay, good.
What Instagram reels? Are you on Instagram?
Yeah, I'm all over it.
Okay. What Instagram reels do you regularly send to friends and family? So there's like a theme. When you look at it, there's all a right. theme.
Yeah. So mostly to my son. Basically, okay, this is so lowbrow. I can't believe you've reduced me to these depths, Nihal. There's this particular black guy who eats food in the most disgusting way. And I mean disgusting, but we love him. I mean, everything you can do. I mean, he's licking his fingers. I mean, he's inhaling his food. It's hideous. But do you know what? It's compelling viewing. I don't know why or what that makes me. My son doesn't want to see it. But I send it to him anyway. So anyway, and he sends me football.
Okay.
He sends me football stuff.
What's his team?
I send him just blokes eating food disgustingly.
That's why I love this question. Because when someone does it, like you've just seen, they nail it. Yeah. Candice Brathwaite is a brilliant author. Yeah. She sends videos of people crying in the gym.
Wow.
That's her thing.
That's dark. That's dark, though, isn't it?
Well, because she's an ultra runner. Right. So she knows the pain of the gym. So that's the thing. Wow. That one's brilliant, though. Okay, so specific videos of one dude who just eats disgustingly. That's what you said.
It takes my breath away every time I watch this guy.
It's been incredible speaking to you.
Oh, Nihal, what a joy. What a joy.
Everything and more than I imagined it would
but
be.
But you know I'm such a big fan of the honesty and that you bring to everything you do. So for me, this is a real thrill. Thank you so much.
Oh, man, it's just been absolutely incredible. Thank you so much for listening, and I mean that. Please subscribe, because the conversations you hear on the radio are not as broad, deep, wide-ranging as the extended versions that exist only
on the Headliners with Nihal Athanaika podcast. Okay, Dina Asher-Smith, that's available now for you to download and listen to at your leisure. Wednesday, Alexis French. Get in touch via social media, or you can email me now that I have my own email address, nihal@bbc.co.uk, perhaps. Ask your own encore questions. Make some suggestions. Next week on the show, we have the gold medal winning rower, Helen Glover. Alongside Helen Glover, we have the author of This Is Going to Hurt, who is back with a kid's book called Dexter Proctor, the 10-year-old doctor. It is, of course, writer, comedian, former doctor, Adam Kay. See you then.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News, I'm Alison Hughes. President Biden says a regional conflict in the Middle East has to be avoided, as Israeli airstrikes have killed nearly 50 people in Lebanon today and hit targets in Gaza and Yemen. Lebanon's prime minister says a million people may have been forced from their homes by the bombardment aimed at the armed group Hezbollah. Dr. Shoki Amin Edin from the International Committee for the Red Cross in Lebanon says the country has been plunged into chaos.
People are suffering from displacement, from economic hardships, as well as struggling to find shelters, to find access to water, to food, and even to essential healthcare that they might need. And sometimes they don't have enough time to gather basic belongings and essential items that they need, which makes, again, the displacement even more concerning for us.
In Yemen, Israeli warplanes have hit the city of Hodeidah. A military statement says the attacks targeted power plants and a seaport. Israel says the facilities were being used by the Houthis to transfer weapons and oil from Iran. A man in his 60s has been arrested on suspicion of gross negligence manslaughter after an 8-year-old boy died of gunshot wounds in Cumbria. Emergency services were called to a farm in the Walkup area yesterday afternoon. A child died of his injuries overnight. The former Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has urged Conservative Party members at their conference in Birmingham to end the squabbling and back whoever replaces him as leader. The four remaining candidates, Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jenrick, Tom Tugendhat and James Cleverly, will be reduced to two by MPs on the 9th and 10th of October. The party membership will then choose the winner. Mr Sunak made a plea for unity.
We must end the division, the backbiting, the squabbling. We mustn't nurse old grudges, but build new friendships. We must always remember what unites us rather than obsessing about where we might differ. Because when we turn in on ourselves, we lose, and the country ends up with a Labour government.
A former Russian spy and his daughter, who were poisoned by the nerve agent Novichok in Salisbury in 2018,